another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my very special guest, Jordan Roberts, former member of the Word of Faith. Jordan, it's good to have you on and to talk about Word of Faith. It is it's something that's a little painful for me to talk about because I think back to all those times that I heard, it's thus saith the Lord, it's the spoken word, and the spoken word is the original seed, and all of these, I don't know, this framework of ideology that was in my head that you had the power to speak things and you basically became a sorcerer with speaking. That was... I would say that that's probably more the destructive version that led to all of this, but then it evolved into what it became, and I'm interested to hear from your perspective how you perceive the Word of Faith movement.
So it kind of evolved for me too. I started off, like, my father actually is where it started. When I was like two, he got saved reading a book by Kenneth Hagin. I remember he'd tell us the story. He was driving with the book in the steering wheel, and, you know, he came from a Catholic background, wasn't really serving, I think, the Lord at the time of his life, but in reading the book, kind of realizing that no one was going to be there on Judgment Day, to help him pass. And so he prayed right there, and got saved. But that started, you know, really like the Kenneth Hagin. That's what we grew up listening to. I had all the tapes, you know, my dad had all the tapes, but I would listen to him as a kid, you know, the old like foam core plastic binders with the tapes in them and all that stuff. And he's exciting, you know, as a kid hearing his stories, you know, what he came through, you know, going to hell and all that stuff. It's, you know, it's entertainment, right? It's really good. And then so, really kind of coming up through that as a kid and going to a Pentecostal church. But interesting for me is a lot of the stuff that I dealt with was really more at home than in the church. The Pentecostal church that I was going to, there was a lot of the, you know, kind of going for the signs and wonders. It was very like deliverance ministry type of driven, you know, you got a demon of this, a demon of that, casting them out, you know, prayers for healing and whatnot. But then it was more of at home where my parents would have like a home group, and they would do a lot of just worship and prayer and, you know, kind of really seeking signs all the time. It's like the sensitivity of the spirit, but it's really that kind of what you've talked about, the manipulation of music, you know, you can create that atmosphere. And I don't think that, you know, my parents saw it that way. I don't think they see it that way even now. But, you know, we'd have the laughter of the Holy Spirit, slain in the Spirit. I think I was 10 when I was baptized in the Spirit, speaking in tongues, doing that whole thing. And really kind of just, you know, as I grew up looking at, my Christianity was, in a sense, superior than others. You know, I had the baptism of the Holy Spirit. I had what other Christians didn't have. You know, if I looked at like a Calvary Chapel, to me, that was like a watered down church. It didn't have the same spirit, right? Then from the Pentecostal church, we moved. We were living in Southern California. I even went to Vineyard a little bit, actually Ontario Vineyard. Had a lot of friends that went there too, so I'd visit occasionally. Then I moved to San Diego and was going to a Foursquare church, and that was when the Brownsville revival hit. Pastor and different members of the church were, you know, traveling to Brownsville to go catch that lightning in a bottle and bring it back to our church, that sort of thing. Kind of the same. I mean, the worship leader at that church was a very talented musician. He was like a blues singer singing at a bar, got saved right away, pretty much became the worship leader. He was just full of talent. We looked at that as, you know, a spiritual gift and all that. But yeah, it was really mostly driven by worship. You know, my dad loved John Wimber. So it was always that start high, end low, you know, the fast song, end it with the slow song. But it was all mostly really worship related. I could care less what the pastor had to say. It was, can you get me to this, the throne room of God kind of atmosphere? So that was a big part of it.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack there. In fact, I'd like to talk through each of those things, and I don't even know if we can do it in an hour. Do I remember correctly that your father is a Pentecostal minister?
He's not actively pastoring right now, and he largely considers himself, which he is, he's more of a teacher than a pastor.
I'm thinking through everything that you just said, and my wheels are spinning in my head. I grew up listening to these tape recordings of Branham. You grew up listening to tape recordings of Hagin. And it's kind of funny now, if you think about it, if you've ever attended mainstream church, you would never see the minister asking people to go home and listen to tapes of himself. That would just be, the minister would think he's full of it if he did this. But we did, and we listened to them over and over again. It sounds like you did as well. And I'm fascinated by that part of the story. But thinking through you said your father's a teacher. It sounds like maybe you might have had some of the fivefold ministry doctrine in your framework. Did you have fivefold ministry as well?
Yeah, definitely. That was definitely a big part of it. I would say one thing that's maybe different than probably what you grew up with Branham. Even though my dad was saved reading Kenneth Hagin and was, he's still a big believer of Kenneth Hagin. One, to give some credit to my dad, is he's a Bible reader. As far as I can remember as a little kid, my dad would wake up at 3 a.m. and read his Bible, study it, you know, have time alone with the Lord, pray, worship. And he did it all the time. I remember I'd run into him if I, you know, maybe I fell asleep on the couch in the living room, you know, he'd come in at 3 and wake me up. My dad never really chased the man on the pulpit. You know, he wasn't like that's the guy, Kenneth Hagin's the guy. Though he probably listened to a lot of him and was encouraged by him, but my dad always believed we could do the same thing, which was largely what it was taught, right? We could do it. So same thing with like when the church we were attending that was going after Brownsville, my dad always thought, that's silly. Like, why don't we just do the same thing here? You know, so to credit my dad, his heart was in the right place, you know, still is. Like, you know, I love my dad, and I mean, he's saved. He's not a confused man. He's, it's just different. We have a little different of a belief, you know, right now. And I kind of trickle in little things here and there in hopes that he'll see it, but maybe he doesn't. Either way, he's a great man. He raised me great, my family. And so definitely happy and have no regrets in that sense.
Yeah, there are many people who are even in, you know, in Branhamism that I would say, I have no reason to believe that they're not saved. I'll say it like that. They read their Bible, they study their Bible. The problem with Branhamism that is probably different than what you grew up with, we would hit these passages in the Bible where what Branham said was the opposite of what we're reading in the text. And we weren't allowed to go so far as to question what he said if there was a discrepancy. So we'd read it and we'd be like, well, brother, I just don't understand this passage in the scripture because he said the opposite, you know, that kind of thing. And I've actually never met somebody in Word of Faith who ever did this. So I would say what we had was a lot more destructive, but there are yet still some similarities, and that's really the core of the Word of Faith doctrine. So when you talk about differences between you and your dad as it relates to Word of Faith, what parts did you keep? What parts did you decide that you did no longer believed? What did that look like for you?
I think the main parts I believe and kept is the gospel. The gospel was still always taught well from my family. Even my extensive family, cousins and whatnot that have kind of grown up in the same thing with me. That's always been the same. I think the biggest difference for me and what really happened, I guess you could say, is where it all started to change was my son got sick and we couldn't figure out what it was. We started doing all that we could. I'm not sure if you've heard of, JGL Ministries, that's now run by Curry Blake, which is John G. Lake's. He has a DHT, I think is what it's called, DHT. We got involved with them, partnered with them, went through all their classes, and basically it's all, basically almost like street healing in a sense, just healing, believing in the divine healing, and, you know, doing all that John G. Lake supposedly did. And we were doing that, anything that we could do to heal my son. And it was really hard for us. There was months where I was falling asleep, praying for my son. I was literally sleeping in the same bed as him, because I'd pray until I fell asleep. And if I woke up, I'd pray again until I fell asleep. And it just wasn't going anywhere. Started seeing a lack of compassion from my church members. It was always like, praying was easy. It's a layup, let's put this healing in, and now let's go get our In-N-Out burger. We're hungry. And really seeing in the Bible, mourning with people and sitting with people in their sorrow was just completely lost. At that time, I was going to probably more prosperity gospel type of church. And there was just a really big indifference there. And my wife, she was over it at that point. She was really, she had found Ray Comfort. She was doing all the street ministry, evangelism was what her big heart was. We got involved with an organization doing that. And there hit a time where it was right 2019, end of 2019, when COVID hit. When I saw that first YouTube video of, people just dying in the streets, COVID, I initially was like, I don't believe this. This is fear tactic. This is world control, whatever reason. They're going to use this to get rid of Donald Trump or something, And I wasn't, I didn't vote for Trump at the time. I'm from Southern California, conservative. Our votes don't count. I started studying everything I could politics. So literally like church and all that was kind of set on the side. What I really started noticing was, I didn't believe anything anymore I was being told. And at the same time, I was seeing these prophets that were starting to prophesy, God said this and God said that about Trump this and Trump that. And because I was so involved with kind of this deep dive I was doing and listening to everything that was happening in news and politics, I was finding that these guys were just regurgitating the same things that they were hearing from somebody else I heard on a podcast, a month before. But this time God told them. I'm like, God didn't tell you so-and-so said that on whatever channel. And that's when I really started thinking, this seems a bit hokey. And then my wife really hit me with once. She says, you need to really look into Kenneth Hagin. And it was a kind of a breaking point in our marriage. Like, she was upset. She saw the destructiveness of it, how I was, trying to heal my son, telling my son to have faith to heal himself. He's just a kid. And it got bad. It got really bad. And so then I set off to study Kenneth Hagin. And that actually led me to one of your episodes that you did with Charles on Kenneth Hagin. And then, so when I found you guys, then forget all the politics. I stopped all of that. And I spent every minute I could listening to your guys. As I listened to the new message that you had, and then I'd go back and start episode 1, 2, 3, see how many I could cram in before your next episode went air. So yeah, you were kind of my Morpheus, and red pilled me out of the matrix.
It's a wonder you didn't go crazy listening to me that many times. And I remember the feeling much like you describe, when you first come in contact with something that challenges your faith a bit, the first thing you think is, oh my gosh, is it real? And then once you start to get a little bit of freedom for critically thinking, you can't get out of it. You're constantly looking and trying to find more information. I did the same thing, and I would go down these rabbit trails. Kenneth Hagin was one of the rabbit trails. Go down the rabbit trail, and oh my gosh, here's another guy who's, he's not saying the same thing as what our leader did, but there's so many similarities. And I was kind of in the same place as you. Part of my story, which I don't talk about much, is I had a family member who was really, really suffering. He went through some very, very difficult health issues. To this day, I get broken up if I talk about it, so I don't. But it was a very traumatic time, and I was kind of in the same place as you, because I was thinking, we are supposed to have enough faith that the person can be healed. And we hear it constantly on these recordings. You can do it. You can have this much faith. If you have just the faith of a mustard seed, you can move mountains, this kind of thing. But then what happens is, whenever it doesn't work, what do you do? There was no help. There's nobody really coming to the family member involved. Their family was struggling, and it's like everybody just wants to shut them off, because here is something that makes them critically think about the whole religion. And what happens is, I think through cognitive dissonance, they try to just reconcile what has happened to this person, but then at the same time, they shut it off so that their minds don't open up to think.
Yeah, for sure. That's definitely, you know, I know, like with my dad, my mom got cancer, and she had, I think she dealt with it for maybe 2 years before going to the doctors. And it was kind of that same mentality of, like, you know, she's going to be healed miraculously. I remember, you know, church getting involved and all of our prayers, doing like a 24-hour fast before finally deciding, like, okay, let's do this. Then she started getting treatment and then went into surgery. And the night before, we, you know, prayed all night, prayed for her. And I remember my dad was really expecting her. And I was expecting this miraculous healing to happen. And the miraculous didn't happen, except for, it's still quite miraculous that the size of the tumor that she had, that it didn't spread, that the surgery was successful. Her recovery was phenomenal. I mean, she was up laughing just hours after surgery. You know, this thing was like the size of a soccer ball, you know, it's huge. And, you know, looking at it now and thinking, like, wow, you know, I almost lost my mom over this. I know my wife lost her grandmother over this. Same thing, where they were expecting healing, and when it finally was, you know, too much, they decided to take her to the doctors. The doctors are kind of like, it's too late, she brought her sooner, you know, and she passed. And so I think about that, like, I'm very happy, obviously, I still have my mom, that she didn't suffer. But, you know, they're not all those positive endings. A lot of people do, it ends in tragedy, and it's sad.
And the irony for us, so this was part of my leaving. This is really what shook me. I had several things that shook me, but that was the big one. And then we went into a mainstream church, and we just happened to go at a time whenever somebody else was struggling with a similar health issue. And the outlook wasn't that great for this person. And I was really curious to see what the church did, because we came from the, it was the precursor to the name it, claim it, you can be healed gospel, right? So I was wondering, how does a mainstream church handle this whenever somebody gets really sick? And it was so unique from my perspective, because I'd never seen it. And yet everybody else just instantly knew what to do, because that's how they were raised. But the church just came together for the family in need. And they would not give them false hope. They didn't say, they would pray for the healing, much like we did. And they would say, now, we're praying by faith. We believe that God could do it. But then there was the caveat, if God chooses not to, we need to come together. We need to help the family. And who's willing to help? And so it was like this charge to excite people to help the person in need. Whereas where we came from, there was the excitement, right? God can heal you. But there was never the situation that could exist, what happens when it doesn't work out. And so I got to watch it firsthand right after leaving the group that we left. And since then, it's changed my life, because anytime somebody's in need, I'm an empath. I want to help people. So whenever somebody's in need, I feel like more empowered than I was whenever I was in the group that we came out of.
Yeah, like you feel like you're in touch with reality, right? Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of the same. When we started going to a Baptist church, and it's kind of that same mentality. You see the church come together. It's the compassion. I see with the friendships and connections that I have, they're very real. They want to know how you're doing, emotionally. It's not just the spiritual. The reason why this happened or that happened is because of the spirit or some spirit on you. Kind of looking at that stuff, it's almost like an escape of reality, right? I committed this sin, but it was the spirit of this. And while you're kind of not taking ownership of that, and you're almost not taking up what the consequences of that thing are that you did. And that's really what I see. It's almost like in a sense, it's kind of like a really smart tactic of the devil. As long as you're not hitting the target, he's okay, right? You no matter what you're doing. And then that's kind of how I see it, because I see it with repentance. I know even with my own life today, I mean, this has only been a couple years now I've been out of it. And it took about 5 years to fully come out. But I have a problem with kind of living in reality. I'm expecting everything's going to be okay. I'm a very optimistic person to begin with, and I just always think it's all going to work out. But the fact is, it might not. It might be bad, and that's okay. God's still good, no matter how bad it is.
So I'm really curious to know more about, you mentioned in the email that you had come out of the Vineyard Church, and just today, actually, I had an email from a person who, as I've been digging into John Wimber and the origins of the Vineyard Church, Chuck Smith, etc., it's interesting because I'll put a little bit of research or information that I have out there. I've not yet even formed an opinion, but people are emailing me already thinking and assuming that I have made an opinion about the group. And so just today, I've got a couple emails I've got to answer about that. But I'm interested to hear from your perspective what the Vineyard Church was like.
With Vineyard, it was a little more toned down, but it was definitely a big emphasis on worship, which with Wimber, that was a big thing for him. I'd say you compare it to, it's real similar to Calvary Chapel, but there was a lot more emphasis. It was kind of a flip. The emphasis on Calvary Chapel was a lot more on the teaching and less on the worship. And Vineyard seemed to be the other way around, a lot more on the worship and not so much on the teaching. And probably because of, what Chuck Smith kind of went through and what he changed, he seemed to be, leaning a lot more towards exegetical teaching. He would be verse by verse. I always looked at that was dumb to even do that. How do you get through all these great treasures of the Bible if you're just going verse by verse? So I'd say Vineyard was a lot more topical preaching and the emphasis on Vineyard or on the worship was really the big thing. But on a side note with Vineyard, I went to a church called Vineyard Extreme, and it was a test run on what they were trying to do, where they took a coffee shop, turned it into a venue that was open, 7 days a week, but on Sundays we had a service. And the idea was, anybody comes to the coffee shop, it allows you the church to make money on the coffee shop and use it as a venue for, music and different things. And then we also were a church that, people could be invited to. So you're almost bringing outsiders into your church. And they don't even know it's a church kind of idea. But that really went up in a big ball of flames, because the guy that was heading it and pastor of it was definitely more into the music and the women and things that he shouldn't be into. And so that kind of failed pretty miserably. But I did make some good friends out of it and still friends with them today.
I saw a video, and I can't remember who sent it to me or which church it was. It might have been even a Vineyard, but there was a minister who was coming in to replace the current pastor. And he came in dressed in just grungy, nasty clothes, and he walked all the way up to the front aisle and sat down, and everybody else is in their fancy Sunday go to meeting, Pentecostal type, you know, dress. And they looked at him, and everybody's scorning him just because of the way he looks as he's dressed. And finally, the pastor who's leaving introduces the guy and says, "Now we have our new pastor, and I want everybody to meet him." And then the grungy guy steps up and goes to the platform and preaches a whole sermon on how God doesn't look at the outward appearance. And in the midst of, I think it was that sermon, I may be mixing memories because this is a long time ago, but I think it was that sermon that they were talking about how, Jesus would go sit with the sinners, the prostitutes, the drunkards, this kind of thing. And he said, what would it be like today if we were to go have service in a bar? And I remember the thought went through my head, oh my gosh, everybody I know would just, they wouldn't even go in the first place, right? But that's something, if you read the biblical Jesus, that's how Jesus acted. He would go to save the lost. And I think out of that concept, there even spun up some bar churches. In fact, I know I've been in contact with one minister who ran some sort of a bar church. I don't think it worked out either, but for different reasons. But the interesting part about everything that you've just described is I actually could get on board with all of that except for the problems that you mentioned, because I think church has become like a box to many people. They don't really think outside of that box. And the gospel was meant to save the lost, not to save the saved. But the saved keep going to the same box, and they preach the salvation to the saved. Well, who's preaching it to the lost, you know? And so I could get on board with this. And that's the funny part about everything that I'm studying in Vineyard. I would have connected pretty well with John Wimber, I think. As a musician, we would have hit it off, but his mentality, I think his heart was in the right place. I'm not certain that many of the themes that emerged, I'm not certain I can get on board with all of them. The hyper-focus on the worship, for example. Worship is good, but you don't make it the primary objective of your meeting, right?
Yeah, I would say too, like what you were saying about the walls of the church, you know, like you're building. Everything is sitting inside that box. When COVID hit and everything got locked down, the church I was attending at the time was at a Marina Center in Seal Beach, California. And that was, you know, it's government owned. So we lost our church, you know, at least the walls. But we're at the beach, and the beach wasn't something, you know, it's public land. Anybody can go to the beach. And I remember calling the pastor, like, "Hey, this is great. You know, the devil made a mistake. He put us outside. Now we can just go have church at the beach. And that's the only place people can pretty much go. It'd be a great place to, you know, to mingle and to share the gospel with people." And, you know, the church itself really just kind of locked down and followed the rules. And I had this hard time where I'm like, here, we're believing in signs and wonders and miracles and healing, and COVID is nothing to us, right? And then on the other side, I see John MacArthur, who I looked at him as like, you know, he's too reformed. Like, I can't get behind this guy. But yet he was fighting, and he was getting sued by Governor Newsom and the state of California, and he kept fighting. And I thought, I got to a point where I'm like, you know, if I'm going to follow a shepherd of the church, I would follow John MacArthur. I don't really even trust my shepherds anymore. That was another kind of reason why I came out of it. I started seeing holes, right? It's like, you talk all this, you know, healing, signs and wonders, but where are they at? Yeah, they're all stories. Somewhere in Africa is where they're at.
It's always Africa. It's weird, but that's the truth. Even in what we came out of, there were the publications that they would put out, and they would talk about all these miraculous healings that was happening in Africa. And yet in the church, I can name several people that had chronic diseases. Some of them died of those diseases, and some of them had been told that they would be healed, and then they died. And that's really the thing for me. The religion failed so many people. And the sad part about it is, whenever it does, the person who died, it's sad, they suffer, they die, but the family suffers long after their death. And I know family members who have had something tragic like that happen, and they just leave Christianity altogether, because if God is going to fail us like this, why would I want to stay in it? This is a powerless God. And that's really, for me, that's really the crux of the problem, because if you paint God into the box that you're trying to paint him in, and God doesn't quite fit in that box, then is the box even accurate? Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. Through this example that I'm talking about, where I had a family member struggling, it shook me really hard. I realized that it had turned into a gospel of divine healing. It had turned into a gospel of excitement. We didn't have worship to the levels that you had, but there were churches that had it to some extent. And they had turned into a gospel, basically as a gospel of hype. And I realized that it just doesn't really fit reality. So I started to become more grounded in reality, and that's part of why I left.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of what some things that resonated with me, what you said was this: when you try to talk to people that are still in it, they don't want to be out of it. And there's also this fear, like, oh, you're messing with my faith. And I know my wife, for a long time, she kept quiet about her feelings, because that, in her mind, she always kept thinking, well, am I going to ruin my husband's faith? Am I going to ruin the faith of my family because I don't believe this stuff? And she struggled with that for a long time. And I think of, there's this quote I saw spray painted on the side of a building in Redondo Beach, California. And it said, "You can't find something you don't believe exists, because even when you found it, you don't believe it's there." And it's kind of that idea that even though it's right in front of you, you don't believe it. And a lot of it is because you don't want to believe it. I think of in The Matrix, when the guy, I forget the character's name, but he defects back into The Matrix and is like, "I know that the stake isn't real." You know, it's like that. It's like, you know, I would just rather live my happy life and believing and hopeful and be okay with it.
Yeah, it's the comfortable non-reality, basically. In fact, there's so many themes of Matrix. I've watched this several times. There's so many themes that fit the cults. It makes me wonder, was the thing actually written after the cults? I know in talking with Dr. Stephen Hassan, the Borg from Star Trek were created as a replica of the way a mind control cult works. You get the central figure, which is the Borg Queen, and then people who are in the Borg Hive, they get the Hive Mind, and if they break away from that, they're always trying to plug back into that Hive Mind, or if they branch out, they'll form their other cluster of splinter groups of Hive Minds. When you take a step back and you understand that some of the worst enemies in sci-fi mimic the things that we came out of, it boggles your mind, right? But you look at some of the people who are in it, and I'm extremely sad for those people, because they can't help it. And many of them are really, really good people.
Yeah, for sure. And that's really one of the big things I do. I try to, you know, talking to my family. I know when I first came out of it, I called my dad. I'd say I was a little upset. Once I realized Kenneth Hagin was kind of a, it was all a hoax. I called my dad. We had a very brief and not very good fatherly son conversation. I called him immediately after I had to apologize. But I started really challenging them, you know, my family on these things. And there's a lot of pushback. And I kind of got to a point where I thought, you know, I can't shine the flashlight bright in their face. It's going to make them recluse back. It's not going to work. If I just trickled information though, here and there, when I find something, it's like, hey, dad, or to my brother and my sister or something, like, hey, did you know this? Did you know that? Largely, they don't want to hear it. My dad will actually, he is open to hearing it. And, you know, he's asked me once, you know, why do you do what you do? And I said, well, I think there's a lot of wolves in attacking the sheep, and there's a lot of protection of the wolves. And I'm looking at myself as somebody that's kind of a watchman to protect the sheep. And I'm giving my story to help those that, you know, maybe had it worse. I mean, I didn't have a bad life. I didn't go through some terrible stuff aside from almost losing my mom. I mean, that could have been really bad. But I see the destruction, and I see how many people have been negatively affected, even far worse, and it's all avoidable. And so I really kind of using my voice and what I learn to help others.
So as you know, I've been digging deeply into the historical roots of all of this, and I've only skimmed the surface. There's so much more to unpack and understand. You can see all the connections, and people can jump to conclusions of why all those connections exist. But for me, it's just simply that there were a lot of different ministers and evangelists who were cross-pollinating ideas. I think that's the biggest, best way to say it. But it gets really interesting when you look at the history that's happening in California. As I've mentioned a few times on the podcast, I was digging into the Foursquare Church because, well, take the Jesus movement. You had Chuck Smith, who came out of the Foursquare Church. You had many of the Foursquare elites were working directly with Branham, inviting Branham to, in fact, whenever they held the 50th anniversary of Pentecostalism, they brought Branham as one of the headline speakers. And they were friendly to him even after the assemblies had chastised him and started sanctioning Branham. So you've got all of these connections back into Foursquare. And then I started looking into Latter Rain and started noticing, well, there's connections with Foursquare to Latter Rain, the Sharon Orphanage, etc. So there seems to be a lot of different paths leading back to Amy Semple McPherson's group. And you just happened to come out of this, so I wanted to talk through that just a bit.
Yeah, kind of funny enough, Amy Semple McPherson, I've been to her house, Amy's Castle. Foursquare owned it for a while. And I think at the time that they owned it, my church did like a dinner there, and we did a tour and, you know, kind of checked her house out, which is interesting. It's in Lake Elsinore. It's kind of away from Hollywood and all the things. And, you know, Angela's Temple, one of my best friends growing up, lived in the apartment complex that is literally about 30 yards from Angela's Temple. Never went inside that building though. But the church that I went to was, I'd say that they were, you know, kind of borderline prosperity gospel. They were definitely roots of, you know, the NAR were involved. I think they installed Jack Hayford as an apostolic elder of the church. I know when I heard that, I was like, you know, oh, that's kind of cool. And my wife was like, that's a red flag. but this is where she was coming out of this before I was. But yeah, I remember, you know, a lot of the studies too, like Azusa Street Revival. I went there. I was living at San Diego at the 100th anniversary. Me and my dad drove up to Azusa Street, and, you know, we were expecting something, and there was nothing going on. It was just a street in the ghetto still, like like it is in most of LA right now. But yeah, that's kind of how that Foursquare stuff, at least in my life, that was the experience I had.
So I'm curious, out of all of these different groups that you've came out of, I know people would ask why you came out of them, but I'm more curious to know what were the similarities that you found between all of these groups? Because when you leave one group and you go to another, usually it's because you have been persuaded in a spiritual leaning, I guess is the way I'll say it, a spiritual leaning toward a direction. So the direction led you from Word of Faith, Pentecostalism, into Vineyard, into Foursquare. What did you see similar between all of these groups?
Yeah, I would say the similarities were kind of blended the lines, where it never felt like I left a group and joined another group. I went from a Pentecostal church to a Foursquare church, from a Foursquare church to another Foursquare church. I moved around a lot, so I didn't sit at one church for too long. But all the churches I went to, you know, a lot of non-denominational churches too, the big blending lines were worship was a big emphasis, signs and wonders were a big emphasis. It's that emotional feeling, you know, very much chaotic in a sense. You know, it's like the believing in all things, but in decency and order. We just didn't have the decency and order.
Part of my curiosity comes from just studying all of the different groups and watching the migrations between them. And part of this started because I have friends who left there was a splinter group of Branhamism, and the first thing they headed for was Bethel Church. And I was like, you're stepping out of one fire into a bigger fire, you know, at that point. And we're not there yet, but we're going to get there. Cheno and I have been talking about the Hobart Freeman cult, which was also this weird spinoff of elements of Word of Faith, elements of Prosperity, Deep Charismatic, Deliverance Ministries. Well, whenever he died, Hobart Freeman died, his cult didn't fully disband, but some of them went to IHOP KC because it was so similar. And so you've got this, I don't know, there's a network of doctrine that is so similar to what you leave that it's comfortable. And back to the Borg hive mind thing, whenever the Borg drones break off and they can't connect back to the main hive, they connect into something else that is similar and compatible, I think is the best way I would say it. And it isn't until, I don't know if you're a Star Trek fan, but it isn't until you take out all of that stuff out of their head that then they can start to integrate into reality. And so we've covered all kinds of sci-fi themes, but you get the picture. These right. groups are often like the bad guys in sci-fi.
Yeah, definitely. I had to remove a lot of stuff, and still doing it. But yeah, I remember when I officially came out, like say the red pill, when I woke up and started to have to relearn how to breathe, I was avoiding certain books of the Bible, certain scriptures, ones that were ingrained in my head, you know, 1 Peter 2:24, like don't even read Peter anymore. You know, I started going more Old Testament, Jeremiah 29:11 was another big one. And I could see, you know, there are differences too, depending on like what church I went to. In the Pentecostal movement, it wasn't so, you know, prosperity gospel. Low prosperity was involved because it's still believing you could, you know, call money down from heaven. But there was the emphasis more on the deliverance. Then going to another church, it was revival, right? Revival was a big thing, especially during the Brownsville revival. Everyone was trying to duct tape that revival to their church any way they could. And I think it's kind of funny when I think about revival and the emphasis on it today and with what's going on with like Bethel and like the Winger video and having family from Bethel that has responded, you know, to his video without watching it somehow. They don't want to do that, right? They don't want to look at the evidence before they make the judgment, but they don't realize that Mike Winger has only just touched the tip of the iceberg, you know, the deep rooted issues that come back that you know, I mean, go back 150 years and more, is the real problem. And I kind of say, ironically, revival's going to happen when the whole charismatic movement kind of blows up and everybody realizes that most of this was a fraud and, you know, people really truly repent and realize we've sinned against the holy God and we need to get on our knees and repent.
And that's really the sad part, because so many elements of this was fiction, pure fiction. There's no way to even try to make it not seem fiction. But yet there were some people in it who were real. They really believed. They really were sincere. They really were doing what they thought they needed to do for God. And so they started teaching, and people built doctrines on the fiction without even knowing it was fiction. And so now you've got this weird, difficult thing to do. I'm having to do it in my head, where you're taking the doctrines and you're comparing it to the Bible, and you're trying to say, okay, what parts of this matched and what parts were built on something that was fiction? Well, then you go back a layer and you realize, okay, well, that layer was fiction. So you rip it out. Well, now you find five other doctrines that was built on top of it. And so you've got this spaghetti mess in your head of things that you're trying to unravel. I've been doing it since 2012, and I feel like every day I feel like I'm just beginning. You know, there's so many things. I can't even imagine a decade from now, as this thing starts to topple even further, how many people are going to be going through the same thing I did and feel like their heads are scrambled? What does it feel like for you when you start to try to separate the truth from the fiction?
Yeah, scrambling. That's a good word for it. There's one of the biggest things is definitely relief. I feel more grounded. I feel like now when I see the word or hear the word in context, that it's like a peace in a sense. Like, oh, this is real spring water. This is fresh. This is what I need. But there's always these things in the back of my head, though. The what about this and what about that? That I think it will always, they'll always be there. In some sense, I don't want to forget some of these things, because I use them now as kind of walls to guard myself. But I also have to be careful too, when I hear something, that I'm not jumping to conclusions either. You know, sometimes I hear somebody say something and it's just red flag after red flag. And, you know, I don't want to do that either. Right. So it's definitely a battle. This is a constant. My brain is at war with itself and my history and past. And was this real? I'll remember something that happened. And then it's like, wait, was that even real? Like, I don't even know anymore. So yeah, definitely.
So I asked earlier, what were the similarities? And I know people were going to be begging me to find out, well, what were the differences? What made you decide to leave that type of religion and go into the church you did? What was the thing that, I guess, what was the thing that bothered you most? And how would you compare the church that you go to now to all of these others that you have left?
The thing that bothered me the most was the lack of compassion dealing with my son and the inability to heal when that was such an emphasis. Realizing that it wasn't true, really kind of coming from your research, and once my eyes kind of opened to this, then it's like, wow, it's this whole thing was like a big scandal in a sense. And it's a scandal on top of another scandal. And that really kind of made me mad and to leave it. And then I found a church that was very theologically sound. The pastor was a great teacher, just going through verse by verse through the Bible and explaining the Bible. It was less about what application, you know, a lot of services and, you know, sermon is how to apply this to your life. And it was less of that, and it was more of, this is just what the Bible says, and I'm just going to explain what it says. What it means to you is really on you, but this is what it says, and this is what God meant when he said this or said that. And so finding that grounding, it was like a relief. I'm like, this is what I need. I need just solid biblical truth taught to me word for word, you know, through the scripture.
Yeah, I think so many people would just feel refreshed if they were to get this. One of the things that I have seen that's similar among all of these in the networks is there is this idea that you should look backwards. Take things like God's generals. You're looking backwards to these are the heroes of the faith. In Branhamism, we look back to Branham. Word of Faith, you look back to Kenneth Hagin, T.L. Osborne, these kind of guys. Almost every movement, Vineyard. I have people with Vineyard who will just die on a hill for John Wimber. And you know, he probably was a great guy. I'm not going to say he wasn't, but it's looking backwards. It's looking to what somebody else has done and their walk with Christ. When I started entering into churches that weren't part of this movement, there was none of that. You never look backwards to some ancient hero of the faith or some dead guy. It was always, what can you do when you leave this building to go be a better person to other people? And that was, for me, that was a mind-shifting, mind-altering, worldview-changing thing that happened to me, because I no longer was looking backwards. I was, in fact, I was examining my own heart, how wrong I was not to want to help all of the other people who, you know, were in not in part of our religion. And that's really, that was the shift that I think changed me the most. So I can relate to that a good bit.
With the focusing on yourself, can also be taught destructively. And being in churches that were prosperity gospel driven, it was always me, how I could be better, what I could do, but it was from a lens of being like Christ. And I think that there's kind of a difference of being Christ-like and being like Christ. I can be Christ-like. I can be loving and kind and patient and helpful and really sharing the gospel, being compassionate and helping the world or helping my neighbors. You know, that's being Christ-like. But walking on water and healing the sick and raising the dead, that, you know, that might not be what I'm supposed to be doing. You know, and not to say that God doesn't still do those things, but to walk around every day acting like I can do this and use affirmations to empower myself to get there is pretty destructive.
Yeah, I call it the literal sorcerer's type gospel. You think that you can do all of these. And it's like you said at the very beginning, you're basically stepping out of reality when you do this. It's a gospel that can't really remain grounded in reality for many people. What advice would you give people who are still in this type of religion?
I say the biggest advice is to be okay with questioning. It's okay to question your pastor. You should be at a church where the pastor's okay with you questioning him. If your pastor's not okay with you questioning, then my advice is to run. But questioning even yourself, what you understand of the word, look into it. I mean, we have good resources online, YouTube, even just Googling websites to really break down, you know, what verses say. And it's okay to look at what other sides of an argument are. To really base a solid opinion and foundation. And God's not going to be mad at you for even questioning him. It's okay. He's a loving and merciful, gracious God. And, you know, really spending time in his word and building that relationship with him is really the most important thing.
Well, that's very good advice. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, John, and really appreciate everything that you and all the guys that are helping you out doing all this stuff. It's been a big blessing for my life.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.